It's Patricia Karpus, host of Untangle, the award-winning podcast that covers topics like optimizing brain health, finding your purpose, how to sleep better, harnessing the power of anxiety, successfully changing habits, finding more happiness and joy, and overall, all the many ways to live your best life. If you enjoy hearing from thought leaders, neuroscientists, psychologists, nutritionists, business leaders, and more, join us wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Addicted Mind podcast. My name is Dwayne Osterlin. I'm your host, and we are on to another episode. So today, my guest is Michelle Hillier, and she is the founder of Breath and Fire, a wellness program that helps people identify gaps in their lives that are holding them back from becoming who they truly want to be and connecting to their authentic self. So Michelle is going to share her story of how the COVID-19 pandemic pushed her to her breaking point, and she had to face her addiction to alcohol and get support and reach out for support and make those changes in her life that helped her move forward and reconnect to her own authenticity and connect with her true self. I think you're going to like this episode. Michelle comes to the podcast with an authentic heart and a willingness just to help others. But before we start, if you are getting a lot out of the Addicted Mind, please rate and review us in iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. I do read them. I really appreciate it. It means a lot to me, and it really does help the podcast get found. And also think about joining our Facebook group. Just go to Facebook, type in the Addicted Mind podcast, and click join. All right, let's go ahead and start this episode. All right, everyone, welcome to another episode of the Addicted Mind podcast. My guest today is Michelle Hillier, and we're going to talk about all things breath and fire. We're going to talk about yoga. We're going to talk about mindfulness, movement, and how that helps people dealing with trauma and recovery and all that stuff. But Michelle, let's first just get to know you and your story, and we'll just jump right in.
Great. Thanks, Dwayne, for having me. I'm really excited to be here and share. Most importantly, you know, spread the love, spread the word, spread the joy of life and recovery. It's a complete 180 where I was 2 years ago. That's for sure. I have to say that. So yeah, I guess, should I share a little bit of how I got here?
Yeah. Let's share a little bit to help people understand your story, because then it'll help people understand what motivates you to do this work and why it's important and how it's helped you and all that. So let's jump in with a little history.
All right. So I always like to start with how I feel now. So I feel in recovery. I have just over a year of sobriety, but I feel like I've been in recovery for a year and a half. That includes a relapse, which is part of many people's story. I took it Absolutely. As a gift. And so July 21 was my actual 1 year of sobriety. So this last 18 months, though, I feel like I've entered my authentic self again, a woman that I lost along the way the last 20, 25 years. And I've really gotten curious in recovery, like, what happened? Where did alcohol fit into that? Where did I go off my path? And how did it take me this long to get here? And most importantly, how did I have to like crack wide open to get access to all the tools to find her again?
Right. To find your spirit, you lost yourself somewhere along the way. Can you give us a little bit of that story of losing yourself? And I think that can be common for a lot of people. We can get caught up in our lives and just forget who we are in a way.
Mm-hmm, for sure. So I was born in a smaller town outside Toronto, Canada. So I'm from Toronto. So a smaller town where drinking was everywhere. Bush parties, alcohol was everywhere. And I loved it. It was the norm. It was also around my family at celebrations. So I saw that where there was alcohol and people were laughing and the room was warm, that seemed like the right thing to do. So I slid into it very easily in high school and university. I would consider myself a sort of normal drinker, but normal for where I lived and who I surrounded myself with. I don't think it's normal at all when I look back.
when I look back. But at the time, it kind of fit into your group. At the time,
it fit into my group. I didn't drink more than anybody else. I didn't black out. I didn't fall down. I binge drank for sure all through high school, university, but I kept it together. I was a elite level dancer. So I consider dance and athletics the same in terms of commitment. And I was like at the top of my game. So it didn't affect that. It didn't affect my grades. I was in the dean's honors list in university. Like I just, it was working for me. Put it that way. Alcohol.
It was working.
It was working for me. A couple hangover mornings and then I'd pick my socks up again and get to class and hit up the A's. So it was never really an issue. From there, I went on to work on a cruise ship for a year. So I'm a dancer. So it was a sort of dream job. And the drinking still continued on that experience. And it was, we had a lot of leisure time. So it was like a party for a year. And again, I found the groups that drank. And I look back at the last, 20 years, Dwayne, and I look like I found the groups that drank always. I that made me feel normal. That, and I never was the heaviest drinker. I was like, oh, I'm normal. I can, and I always got the term, wow, Michelle can really drink. And I kind of wore it like a badge of honor.
Right.
Right.
But you weren't the worst, right? So you could say, I'm not that bad. I'm not bad as that person over there,
but
I can hold my own.
I can hold my own. And through that too, I had to maintain my physique as a dancer. I was a fitness instructor. So I was in the wellness space, but still sort of destroying myself inside with alcohol. And I kind of knew it. I kind of like had glimmers of that back in my early 20s, late 20s, which was 20 years ago. But I kind of just let it go. It's working for me. Keep it going. So then I guess fast forward, I then got into marriage, got into motherhood, and life sort of came to a slow. It slowed down. And I'm sure a lot of, if there are any parents listening to any of your listeners, especially mothers, like my giving birth to my newborn was, it just rocked my world. My identity was totally shooken. It was, at that time too, I've missed it a little part. I was dancing on the cruise ship, came back, performed professionally. So here I was using my skills and my craft and making money, but I was working on all of the weekends and evenings as a performer. So I thought, this is not for me. I kind of want to work when regular people work. So I became a teacher. So I was a high school teacher, dance drama, still drank, partied on the weekends. Like I found the crowd, found the teachers that drank and like my staff, it was working. And then I decided after 3 years of teaching that I don't like to follow rules. So I kind of knew this as a kid. I'm a bit of a rebel, a bit of a risk taker. Again, this kind of ties into alcoholic thinking, the rules don't apply to me. Like that, even in my recovery, I struggled with a bit of that with the 12-step program at the beginning. Like, oh, that's not for me. Those are for the other people. So I had this other, maybe my ego is speaking here, but because I'm trying to dismantle it in my recovery, that's for sure. Is like, I thought I was better than that. I thought that I could do it my way. And my way was going to be the creative way, the right way. And so they kind of had that mentality when I left teaching, but it worked in my favor because I started my own business. So I guess my entrepreneurial spirit was sort of sparked and I created a company that provided dance and movement resources and workshops and teacher trainings for teachers across North America. We were in the US a lot as well. And I was at the top of my game in about 2012. I had a team of facilitators and then I got pregnant with my son who is 10 now. And it was totally planned and we wanted him more than ever, but I didn't realize how much it would shake my identity and take away that free time that I had to drink and party. Cause you can't
drink and party and work.
Yeah. And work. And my work involved a lot of travel. So here I am in hotels and airports and conferences. Booze is flowing, as you can imagine, at any sort of event like that, and normalized.
Yeah.
So I'm now new mom, sort of grounded at home because you get very isolated. And I found it very boring. I found the routine of motherhood. And I feel guilty even saying that, but it's just the truth because life is just slow. It's about this beautiful little specimen of a baby that needs you and nothing else can happen. So guess what I did?
And I don't, I think that's a reality of parenthood. I'm a parent and I can totally understand that. This shifts everything, all of your thinking. And some of it is so amazing and some of it is so hard. And just difficult. And so it's a mix of that. So I totally get it.
Yeah. So, you know, like, I found alcohol as an escape. It took sort of the boredom, the edge off, when I was isolated, it gave me something to feel like I was doing that was fun. Like that right. made me feel like and then I found the mummies that drink. I found the mummies in the park groups that drink. And I don't know if it's just a mom thing or a dad thing, but, you know, oh, come for a play date, bring your babies and bring a bottle of wine. Perfect. So that it also continued me to continue drinking and finding groups that, like, I consider myself an opportunistic drinker. And I thought this was normal.
Right.
This was what normal people did.
But it's like you said earlier, you're losing something there. You're losing yourself. It's not really.
That's right.
You know, you're getting you're getting more and more lost as this goes along.
That, and that's what I look back in lots of reflection and recovery of like what are the pieces, the dots that put this together? And it's very much connected to loss of identity. And then I would mask it with alcohol because that would cover up the feelings, because all we want to do is change the way we feel. That's what I take from why I drank. I don't want to be angry. I don't want to be resentful. I don't want to be sad. I even when I was happy, I would reward myself with alcohol. I was a very happy social drinker. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So I guess the story goes on where after I had my son, his name is James, and he's the love of my life now, poor always has been. But I then joined a very intense workout group to, you know, shake the last bit of baby weight, which I never think anybody needs to do. But that was my sort of goal. And I met with a group of very competitive women. And through that process, I tore both hip labrums. So I I had a predisposition from birth that I didn't know about. So my hips were already wonky. Then you add in childbirth, and there was always something kind of wrong with them my whole dance career, but I didn't pay attention to it. So after childbirth, he was about 3 or 4, I tore both labrums, and then arthritis kicked into both of them very badly to the point where I hardly could walk. So guess what I did? I drank over it because the pain, to numb the pain, to also identity. Whoa, you're now going to take away my movement? Because I at that time was doing a lot of corporate activations and wellness sessions and workshops. And now you're going to make me grounded. Like I'm saying you as in the universe. You're going to now take away my movement, my identity to move.
Yeah, it's slowly taking away these things from you and you don't know how to cope. But alcohol works.
Alcohol worked at the time. It did. So I went to see a surgeon and I thought it was going to be a simple like laparoscopic surgery. And he looked at all my images and said, Michelle, both of your hips need to be fully replaced. So I had double hip replacement surgery in 2018. It was shocking. Again, completely grounded me, isolated me in my recovery while I was, you know, in the lazy boy with the compressor machine and the ice machine, and I couldn't go anywhere. I couldn't move. It was very much like a precursor to what I felt like in COVID, like the isolation at home in my not being able to go anywhere. So, you know, the post-surgery recovery, I definitely, alcohol took an edge off. And that's the first time I started drinking, I'd say alone. I was always a social drinker. I don't remember a time ever in my 20s and 30s where I would drink alone. It connected me to people. It was my connector to groups, to my partners. It was a way to connect. So in the boredom of the hip surgery recovery, I was drinking alone. And it did trigger me, like, this doesn't seem right. This doesn't feel right.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem right that I'm doing this alone, but I did it.
Yeah. And everything's been taken away from you. I mean, you're slowly losing all of these things. And I think like what you're saying specifically, and we'll get into this more as we talk about it, movement, body movement. It took that body from movement. You as well.
I couldn't walk. Like I was so used to doing, my body served me well my whole life. I didn't have one injury growing up, dancing, fitness instructor, nothing. And my body worked for me. It always did what I wanted. And now I was out of control. Which is another piece of why I was drinking. Whenever I felt an element of out of control or wanting to change the way I feel, it would just take that edge right off it all. So I felt very out of control with the hip surgeries. So then I did all the right things, physio. I also, though, Dwayne, I pulled my, when I look back, I never wanted people to think my whole life that there was adversity with my, like, I never wanted them to think that I couldn't do something. And that might be a conditioning of my mom putting me on stage at a young age, like the star. And I was always got accolades that way. I felt very loved that way. And so I never wanted to let people know when things were not going well. So even in my hip recovery, when things were rough, I still, oh, I'm good. I got this. I'm like, wow, Michelle, you're recovering so quick. You're a star. I'm like, I'm just being honest. It wasn't a star, but I didn't want to let people into that. And now I do. Now I'm like, I tell people I'm an open book with my emotions in recovery, but I didn't want to.
Yeah. I mean, at the time you definitely probably were stuck. I mean, if you showed this part of you, it wasn't allowed. It wasn't lovable. It wasn't good. And you just do it automatically. You just hide that need for support.
That's a very good way to put it. Hide the need for support. And that's huge in my recovery, is letting people in. And my support group, we can talk about that after.
It makes you vulnerable. I mean, when we ask for support, it makes us vulnerable to other people who... Absolutely. If we're afraid of that, then we're not going to do it, and then we're not going to get that support.
That's right. So I kept it all together on the surface while still drinking. And so then fast forward to right before the pandemic, I was healed. I felt good. My hips felt strong again. I was back. My 2020 calendar was booked with keynote presentations and travel and workshops. But I was still obviously drinking. They're a high functioning alcoholic, if I look back at the patterns. Part of me inside was thinking, how, if I'm in the wellness space, telling people on stages to take care of themselves and get hired as a wellness speaker, I'm drinking. Something feels off. And these were thoughts I had for probably over 10 years, but I didn't know how to stop. I thought, how do I do it? Because it was so connected to my social fabric, to what I thought fun was. To the people, I thought, how would I hang out with them if we don't drink? Well, I know now in recovery, we hang out all the time. We don't have to drink. But these were the thoughts that I had. I thought, what would my life look like without alcohol? And then I would just not want to think about it and continue drinking. So 2020, the pandemic, I get an email probably every other day saying, like, event is canceled, event is postponed, event is moved to 2020, 21, 22. And I had lost all of my work, which was my escape, for sure. One of my escapes. Yeah. So with the isolation, my husband and I were now divorced after in recovery, a very amicable divorce that we co-parent our son. But in recovery, I came to many realizations that the marriage was no longer working, which I think is quite common as I'm learning. We did our best to, when COVID arrived, we were in our condo there. We were like a box in the sky, locked up. Isolated. I couldn't go anywhere. So I had to just lean hard into my second escape, which was booze. Wow. And him and I drank together. We connected together, and he's a normal drinker. He's not an alcoholic. So July of 2020, we both decided, he decided that we should stop drinking. Let's give it a try and stop. I think we're drinking too much. And I'm sure you can understand with COVID, it was glamorized. Get stock up on your booze, have Zoom parties. Like, it was, booze was set up. I was like, I got this.
Yeah, it was a way to escape all of this.
It was. And in Ontario, in our province, like the health, obviously hospitals and everything were open, and the liquor stores was an essential service. They stayed open. It's wild when you think about that.
Alcohol, it's essential.
Alcohol is essential.
Our society's not going to survive if we don't have this flowing.
I think there are people afraid of what people would happen if they stopped.
Yeah.
What happened to our healthcare system?
I don't know. Absolutely. I know it's kind of crazy thinking, but I probably. And I was wondering too, because now almost everything is taken from you at this moment. And it makes a lot of sense that without all of this escape and avoidance behaviors, and you can't get support and you can't talk to anybody and you can't let anybody in. It just seems like, alcohol would really help with that in a way, or at least
in a way.
When I say help, I don't really mean help.
We know what that means. Check out. It helped, and it worked until it didn't work. So we, in air quotes, stopped in July. He stopped drinking. And that's when I felt like an addict. That's when I felt like the hiding, the sneaking, the lying, because I was still drinking. I was still determined to keep drinking. And I feel a lot of shame about that, which I've processed and I'm actually working through it. But I was like that woman I saw, I would read about or see in movies where they hide alcohol. Who does that? Like in their homes or go out of the house to go and get it. Like I was doing all of that because I didn't know what else to do to escape. But the behaviors attached to it were so not like me.
Right. And that's really where you really started to see that I've lost myself here.
I've lost myself. And my girlfriends were very concerned about me. They were sort of rallying around me, around with my husband, saying, Michelle needs help. And I was not willing to hear it. And I remember saying, if there's an intervention, I'm going to lose my mind. They didn't do a real intervention, but they definitely did. They sought out different treatment center options for me and presented me with one that they thought I'd go to that was more like, you know, it was beautiful in an area of Canada called Muskoka. Uh-huh. And it was, it had yoga and it had delicious food and nature. And they knew that I would get behind something like that a little bit more.
So they, in a way, could see your suffering more than you could admit to it.
For sure. I was actually grateful that they presented me with it because I did know I was in trouble. I knew I was drinking way too much. I think for the first time, because I'm a very even-keeled emotional person. I've been quite upbeat my whole life. And I feel like I got a glimmer of what depression would be like. So I was under the covers at 2 p.m. I had no motivation. I was worried about the way my son was viewing me. I wasn't myself. He was worried about me. I just was not myself. I was lost. I didn't know where to go and what to do and how to stop. And we didn't know when the pandemic was going to stop. So I thought, when is this? It was a really, really dark time.
Yeah, it sounds for sure. It sounds very dark. And
it was not myself. And so that was about two years ago, right around now, like September, October, November was when I was just hanging on, drinking privately, sneaking, lying, like I mentioned. And I then had a long walk with one of my closest girlfriends and she broke down. I broke down and she's like, just Michelle, just surrender. Just go to one of these treatment centers. Just do it. Just 30 days, go in and check it out and see what. So that was a huge deal for me as the woman that didn't want to show that I had any adversity. So I went to a treatment center for 30 days where I really saw, number one, a chance for me to be away from my substance. So I couldn't get access to any alcohol, which was exactly what I needed, but also a chance to be alone for 30 days. I had never spent any time alone my whole life. I'm an only child. I had family around me all the time. I always had roommates. I always had boyfriends or husband. I had never lived alone. It was wild when I looked back. It was my first time alone in 30 days.
And you have to really begin to face yourself when you're alone.
That's it. And that's what I didn't want to do. Even when I was alone during the last couple of years of drinking, it's because I drank because I didn't even want to be alone sober. I was so unsure of my identity and who I was. And I've come so far from that. I can't believe it. So I love being alone now. I totally love my solitude. It's amazing what has happened in recovery. So I came out of the treatment center and my husband and I separated. And now, I'm living like a totally different life in sobriety.
Yeah. I've heard the saying before, part of recovery is learning how to turn loneliness into solitude, just like you said. And being able to do that over time. So you go to this treatment center and you start to go through this process and in a way, I guess, find yourself again or find your authentic self. How did you start to do that?
I think the solitude was a big piece, just being in my own room every night by myself, starting to develop routines that I like. Like I used to teach people about a morning routine, yet I never did one. So I'm actually now putting into practice what I was sharing with people. I spent a lot of time alone. I think that's number one. And obviously had great, the programming there, all the information that I gathered. It was a month of discovery and learning about my addiction and learning about alcoholism and seeing it as it is and not as a shameful, stigmatized thing. I also didn't want to call myself an alcoholic for about 7 months. I was so against it, which I think is quite common.
I'm not going to say this out loud.
Yeah, I think I was in a little denial still. But I think what started happening was I was moving my body as well for me. I was always in a teaching, facilitating, leading role. So now it was just me. I went for long walks. I would do my own yoga. I never really did things for me. I've realized that it was always for others and for my son and for the joy of other people. But I really had to go in and maybe just be a little selfish and take care of myself.
Yeah, it's like you had this amazing skill set that you could give to other people, yet you couldn't give it to yourself for all our reasons for that, all our blocks and all our stuff. And it sounds like in moving through this process, you're able to now give these skills of movement, of yoga, truly to yourself.
I've never actually made that connection that you just made, and it's so true. Yeah, it is very true. Everything I do for myself is what I've been doing for others, but more. It's more enriched now with the knowledge of recovery and all the amazing resources that I've had access to. So when I came out of the treatment center, I pulled the old ego, star captain recovery. I decided to not work a 12-step program and do it my own way. I'm going to create my own recovery model, which led me to relapsing in June of last year, 2021. And then that was a big wake-up call for me to just surrender again to letting people in, letting a program in that works, getting a great new therapist that specializes in addictions. And those three together have made me completely stronger in my last year of sobriety. Yeah.
That's amazing. That's so great to hear and to be able to do that. And sometimes those bumps in the road are the things we need that kind of kick us again back into our process.
I thought I could drink normally again. That's what I tried to do. I think I just have one glass of wine. And it's amazing what this addiction and this disease does. It takes us right back. It takes right back to where I left off. There was no way. And then what I was suffering with was the anxiety of the relapsing and not telling anybody. That was horrible.
Right. And then, all that fear of being a disappointment and not being good enough. Yeah. And it's like sometimes these things happen to, I guess, just help us face all those things again, on a new level. And just dig a little deeper and go a little farther. So let's talk a little bit about, as we were saying earlier, you have this skill set around breath work and mindfulness and yoga and movement and how that has become part of this recovery process and how you're doing that for yourself and then also sharing it with other people.
Yeah, I'd love to share this. So I had had my own, like I mentioned, my own business that involved movement and mindfulness and wellness principles for, since 2007. But what really came of being alone in solitude, in recovery, moving my way, exploring breath work, exploring meditation, more and more deeper personal reflection, I started to think that that's where breath and fire was truly birthed out of my recovery. It was all the things I was doing, thinking, and journaling. I've never been a journaler my entire life. And now I'm quite a daily journal. I write every day. I feel like I have to. And through that is where I saw myself creating. I got my creative spark has been fired again in recovery. I think it was dimming. And that's the whole connection to the idea of the flame. So the fire piece. So during the last couple of years leading up to the pandemic, and then especially during the lockdown, because we were locked down for a long time in Toronto. We were the city the most in the world that was locked down the longest. Wow. So we were isolated and kept in a lot. It was
hard. That was so hard for everybody. It was so hard on so many levels. Yeah.
Yeah. So I considered myself, our spirit, our flame, our fire, our home, mine was like on a pilot light. Like it was just flickering. I could not give it anything anymore. Like I think after the hip surgeries, recovering from them and then the pandemic, I couldn't get my fire. And then I thought about the years before that, it was like a blazing inferno. I was going constantly. For about 20 years, I would say no. I would never say no to anything. I always had FOMO. I was busy in my schedule. If I had a free hour, I'd fill it with, a walk with a friend or a visit there or a drink here. I just felt like I never found my breath. So I'm like, hey, Michelle, you have either a pilot light or a blazing inferno. how do we find this optimal, like, controlled blaze? And that's the birth of Breath and Fire, is recognizing, and from doing it from personal experience, recognizing in my day, when do I need breath and when do I need fire? And I'm so attuned to it now. So if I've been in a social situation, or even after this talk we have right now, it's fire for me, because my, you know, my nervous system is up, and I'm going to go, I've already planned. It's activated, right? I'm going to go for probably a nice long stroll or sit on a rock in the sun after we do this, because that's my breath. Because I know I have some more fire later today. So I never was aware. It's all awareness. And I'll catch myself when I've been around people too much. It's like someone, a pretend person myself, taps me on the shoulder, get out, time to go find your breath. Which means for me, it can be walking, having a bath, meditating, having a rest, having a nap. It could be anything, being in nature. That's ways to find my breath. And then fire, for me, is like social situations and moving my body, doing hobbies, activities, having phone calls. But it's that balance that I need. And that keeps me healthy when I'm in the balance, keeps me in the flow.
Yeah, it's finding that middle way and learning how to live in our middle way and balancing those, you know, balancing our nervous system, being aware of our nervous system, that these things are happening even maybe on an unconscious level, and being aware of that and appreciating it.
Mm-hmm, for sure. And I can see it in others too. And I think, like, and that's what my program is called, Homecoming. It's a 3-week intensive where they get really, they zoom into they do a personal inventory of what brings me breath, what things do I love that are in the breath category, what's in the fire, and then how can I build those into my day? And I realize when I speak to others, their life is full of fire, mostly. It's go, go, go. It's kids' activities. It's racing here. Work creates a lot of fire. Then they're doing this. And it's like, when are you taking time, even 10 minutes, to just sit? Just 10 minutes and let your nervous system settle, find your breath. And I love breath work so much. Meditation's been such a big part of my recovery. But yeah, just having people recognize it.
Yeah. So being able to recognize that, right, is maybe the first part, being able to see that, and then having the tools to actually do it. So let's talk about movement, breath work, yoga, and how using that can help you find both sides of this.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I love this. So I guess with the movement piece, so I was traditionally, I'll just speak about my experience and then tie it into how I work with others. I was always of the mentality that harder, faster, stronger, workout, find the hottest trend, CrossFit, whatever, running. And that is exhausting. And also, as we age, it doesn't serve our body that well. And if many clients that are, you know, women in their 50s and 60s with knee issues or back issues, and I'm like, why are you still going to a gym? Or why are you still running if it hurts? I'm like, I'm done hurting. I don't want my body to feel that way. And that's all new in recovery as well, is that I want, so the movement that I share with others, it is again birthed out of my just moving that I started doing during recoveries, putting great music on, functional, intentional movement, and not for an hour. I always teach people or share with people that little breaks through the day. So getting up in the morning and as easy as like jumping around, shaking, putting music on, if you want to dance a little bit or move around, if you want to squat or do a stretch or whatever it is, but something that I always say, you're moving the energy, move the energy through your body. And it's going to feel weird. You're going to have that little voice in your head that'll say, what am I doing? Right. I feel stupid.
Right.
But just shaking and move. And that's all like moving any stuck, that feeling of stuckness. A lot of my clients say, I feel stuck in my body. Well, you know what? You have access to move it, and move it in like unconventional and functional ways, swinging, twisting, shaking. So that's all that's new for me to share that with them. And then the yoga piece, I'm a certified yoga and teacher, but I really believe in fusion. So the shaking, twisting, jumping stuff, and then the yoga flow of some sort, whether that be finding a posture that you feel a great deep stretch in and staying in it and breathing in it. But just finding those moments of flexibility and focus, that's where the yoga sort of comes in. And then the third piece, the breath work, is the connection to, you know, obviously to our breath. and not judging it. And meditation is always tricky for people. They always think, oh, I can't meditate, Michelle. I can't sit still. My brain, go, go, go.
Right, right.
Really, it's okay, because meditation is just being aware of our thoughts. That's what I teach people, that, you know, sitting in physical stillness, and just for 5 minutes even, closing your eyes. If you want to have some music on, great. Connect to your breath, be aware of it. And then, yes, thoughts are going to come. And then just observe them. Just be like clouds passing by, like, oh, there's that one. Oh man, there's that one again. And you just observe them, but you don't let them drop into a feeling, because that's when we get stuck in the story. So just letting the thoughts go by, and they're like, oh, that seems easy enough. I can try that. It's the non-judge. Really, Duane, it's the non-judgment piece. I teach people not to judge the way they move their bodies, because we do. We have that voice in our head that says we have to look like somebody, do it like them, copy them, and my way is not the right way. Your way is always the right way.
Yeah,
that's how I feel about movement and breath work. Always the right way, the way you want to move. You got to shut that voice up.
It is what it is. How has this work for you, doing this work in this new way, helped connect you to your authentic self?
Oh, yeah. I think the meditation, the daily meditation has just settled. It's made me get curious and become more acquainted with my quiet self that I didn't think I had. I was conditioned and told by my parents that I was a performer. So I thought I always had to be an extrovert. I think that's who I was groomed to be. So I think even those social situations that I was put in for 25 years, that's where drinking also helped. Not that I was shy, but that it made me more extroverted, because that's who I thought I should be, is this like, oh, she's the dancer, performer. Here she comes to the party. She's going to perform for us. Well, I got to get pretty loopy to do that, because it's not my authentic self. So remove the alcohol, body awareness, connection to breath. It's like, oh, there she is, the quiet girl. And I like her. She's calm. Yeah. And I didn't know her for 25 years.
It's like connecting to your whole person. And I'm watching you as we're talking, and the audience will be listening to this, so they won't see it. But I love how you put your hands on your chest and your heart, and you just held yourself so close. It was so loving. And I think, you know, that's just amazing, because it just shows that connection and how this work of recovery, breath work, mindfulness, and you know, therapy and all these things bring us home to ourselves.
Yeah. That's the whole message of homecoming. The program that I do is finding home, finding your flame, finding your spirit. And we get lost along the way, big time. And alcohol and, you know, substances really take us down a totally different trajectory. So yeah, just and I was going to say one thing about the quiet girl. I forgot now. Something about the essence connected with alcohol, but something to do with just not having that crutch or that thing anymore in my life is just so freeing. I feel liberated not having to drink anymore. And like the obsession is gone. This obsession is gone. And I don't want to do that to myself anymore. When I think about, even from a physiological perspective, I was putting toxins in my body heavily for decades. And so I just have a whole different view on it. Yeah. With work. It's daily work for sure.
It comes with work. It's not, it doesn't happen. I mean, maybe it happens for some people, but I always feel, usually it's a little bit of effort and work, and sometimes a little bit of sadness and pain and grief and loss, but it's worth it to get to the other side. It is. So Michelle, we're coming up on our time. So this has been such a great story, and I love talking with you, and I can just feel your passion, and I can feel that journey, I guess I could say. I can see the journey in you, and I love seeing that in people. It's so exhilarating and inspiring. So anyway, one more question before we go. Okay. What I like to ask guests is, if someone is out there and maybe they're hurting, struggling, lost, feel disconnected from their authentic self, and you could tell them one thing, what would you want to tell them? What would you want to say? You could tell them one thing.
The one thing would be, the work is worth it.
the work that is comes worth with it.
But I think I'd also have them think back to a time when they felt like their authentic self and try to find a photo and look at it and remember how they felt. Go into the feeling, drop into the heart. How did you feel and what's changed?
Awesome. Thank you so much. So how can people find more about you if they have more questions or they want to reach out to you? How can they find you?
Yeah, sure. So my website is breathandfire.com, and I offer the homecoming program as a 3-week intensive. The next one, five run throughout the year. You don't have to be in Canada. It is self-directed and also live on Zoom 3 times a week. So you can do it from wherever you are. So check that out. And then I also do keynote speaking and workshops for all organizations. I always say, if they're human, they're my audience. Doesn't matter at all if they're in any industry at all. So they can find all that information on the website. And Instagram is a great place to see more dynamic updates as opposed to the website. And I'm at Michelle_breathandfire.
Awesome. And I will put all that information in the show notes as well at theaddictedmind.com. Michelle, thank you so much for coming on and just sharing your wisdom, your story with everyone. I really appreciate it.
No problem. And Dwayne, let's take one big breath together at the end to close out.
Sounds Ready? Good.
So drop right. your shoulders, sit up nice and tall, put one hand on your heart, one on your belly. Let's breathe in through the nose, close the eyes. Hold it. And then I want you to do a nice, beautiful sigh to exhale. Let it go. Yeah, there's lots of power in one breath. Never forget that.
Thank you so much, Michelle.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to the Addicted Mind podcast as usual. All the show notes will be at theaddictedmind.com. So you can find all the links to Michelle's work and her Breath and Fire program. So check that out. Also, if you are enjoying the Addicted Mind and you enjoyed this episode, please share it with a friend. Or write a review. Either one, it's great. I appreciate it. Thank you so much. And join our Facebook group. Just go to Facebook, type in the Addicted Mind podcast, and click join. All right, everyone. Have a wonderful rest of your day, and I will talk to you on the next episode.
I'm Madeline, and I'm the host of the Happiest Sober podcast. I got sober in my 20s after a decade of gray area drinking, and the greatest plot twist of all time was realizing that alcohol, the thing that I thought made my life the most happy and fun and exciting, was actually the exact thing preventing me from living my happiest and best life. My mom is 40 years sober, and she joins me on my podcast very often. I like to call her my part-time co-host, and I also bring you solo episodes where I share my top tips, tricks, and mindset shifts in sobriety, and lots of how-tos for navigating all the things sober, from weddings to parties to holidays to bachelorette parties to trips. I'm also joined by so many guests who come on and share their sober stories, and they're all so, so inspiring. I'm here to show you that life doesn't end when you quit drinking. In fact, it's very much the opposite. And no matter what your relationship was with alcohol, life can be the absolute happiest when you're sober. New episodes come out every Tuesday. You can listen to Happiest Sober podcast wherever you get your podcasts.